All right. I'm here with Eckhard Walter from LiveOps, who actually I first learned about by my friend Jan Pedersen when he was chief scientist at Yahoo, saying that he had a ticket for an expensive conference, then calling out and said, "Hey, Andreas, sorry, Eckhard snatched your ticket for the conference." So I had you in my book, including your mobile number for years, but we finally met half a year ago when I was at LiveOps. And today, Eckhard is going to share with us his 6 insights into the world.
Well, hopefully into the world of work, not just into the world. So we have 6 hypotheses, what it takes for people to work together with quality. So there is sort of commodity work, is this image right or green, the traditional crowdsourcing. And then you have 3 work types. This is really the collective intelligence piece.
Where you, for me, that is 1, the decompositional or parallel collective intelligence.
Parallel collective intelligence.
And 2 would be the portfolio collective intelligence.
Yes.
We'll try to have as much diversity as possible. And 3 would be the interaction collective intelligence, where people build on what other people are doing, Wikipedia being the prime example.
So that's right. So since we're talking about work tasks like customer care, you know, where variance is very undesirable, we're really talking about the first. And so,
do you want another? Do you want an espresso?
It's good.
Yeah.
No.
All right. So here's your other espresso. All right.
All right. So the first hypothesis is humans with shared goals work best in small groups.
Humans with shared goals work best in small groups.
Yes. Shared goals is the key thing. So, for example, if you are trying to decide if something is green or blue, you know, classic Mechanical Turk task, that's not a shared goal. You don't really care. But customer care, being smart, and I think this is a combination of crowdsourcing towards the collective intelligence for Wikipedia, where you need to do some learning from others to get better. Right. When you're deciding red or blue, you don't really care. There's natural variance. But the whole notion of customer care or claims client, there's some notion of individual intelligence and some shared goal, namely you want to get better. And that works best in small teams. And the whole idea is that small teams form, and it's the two pizza rule at Amazon.
Two pizza team, yep.
Two pizza team. Namely, the communication cost is low. Lower, right? It goes up n squared to sort of get the same team. And you get natural competition between teams. I'm better than the other team. So the whole idea is find small teams, let them compete, then you get some diversity of ideas in the team, but you also get some quality control across the process. Hypothesis 1. And it is backed up by LiveOps, the work model for LiveOps, which is pure crowdsourcing, beats any other work model in quality, except very small teams. A very small team can beat LiveOps today. And the reason is that team pulls together, they have a shared goal, and they learn from each other very quickly.
Now, one question I have is, many startups,
yes,
with small teams, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 people,
right,
fail over stupid people issues.
Very good.
So they have a shared goal, which is usually actually not just to get rich, but probably something about the domain as well. Why can't people get the act together and just take a deep breath and see the world with fresh eyes and say, hey, let's do this together, but get hung up in those random discussions? Being advised a number of companies, believe me, I've had more conversation on this than I ever cared for.
I believe the fundamental problem in any small team is incorrect assumptions. I think people very often are on 2 completely different lines. They intersect and they say, oh, we completely agree. Yet their assumptions, how they get to this point, are totally different. And then if you move along the line, the next problem you hit, you come up with completely different answers because you're on a different line. And I've seen this over and over and over again.
Beautiful analogy. Yes, it fits my mental model. I never thought about it as well as you just expressed it, but it absolutely makes sense that at some stage those two trajectories happen to be crossing.
That's exactly right.
But the momentum behind them takes them in very different directions.
That's exactly right. You are, you know, we can find an analogy like you are on Mars, I'm on Venus, or on Earth, the gravity's different, we both happen to hold an object, we assume it's the same thing, we let go, it goes in a different direction, we're totally surprised.
Okay.
Lots of. So that's why I think shared groups, when their assumptions are wrong, fail. And actually, I believe innovation completely breaks if there are not the same assumption what creates value. So I'll give you, Yahoo fell apart because the assumption of every single team what created value, attention, money, was completely different. Right? So Google had a very simple view. Ads, same, you know, the most relevant ad is content. We will add relevance, we will make money.
For me, it is interesting when I talk about, in very neutral terms, with a straight face, customer value. Possibly people want to know about customer lifetime value, customer network value, and so forth. And then, after I do what they want me to do, I just pose the question about, what about the value you as a company provide to the customer? Shouldn't that maybe be part of a consideration? And in the world of network effects, shouldn't you maybe also think about the value the other customers provide to that customer?
Yes.
And for most companies, you are lucky if you manage to extend their concept of customer lifetime value to also take into account the relationship they have with the customer from pure transaction value to relation value.
Right.
And if you extend it not only to the one customer, but also to his network of customers.
Yes.
But the notion of flipping the arrow and saying, actually, what do you do for the customer? And equally well, I give a talk at a conference for operators where I said, well, you guys are solving the world, what can we do for the customers? Why don't you flip the arrow as well and say, hey, what can the customer do for us? Which brings us, of course, to the sort of Web2 aspect.
Which is,
so I think sometimes it's a simple term where people think they're talking about the same stuff, maybe customer value. Turns out, very different assumptions.
I think that's very different assumptions. And I'll give you one other problem with customer value is we've always talked about the innovator's dilemma, right? It's very, very clear. The problem is companies measure, the only thing you can really measure is money. Because everything else has assumptions. I mean, I'll simplify this for a business person. Any disruptive business has a hockey stick.
By the way, on hockey stick, I challenge you and all listeners of this recording to send me a graph which is on a plot where an exponential line is a straight line, which is a semi-log plot.
Yeah, semi-log.
And please, asw@viking.com is the email address. Send me a plot. Post it somewhere. Send me the URL. Use Facebook Connect to post the link to the URL on my blog. And show me the one which, on a semi-log scale, actually is not a straight line. So my theory is that hockey sticks are post-fact explanations where the fluctuations occur at the right time.
Okay. I think that's...
But hey, you know, the verdict is out.
The problem is businesses are very good at managing towards linear growth because you can predict in 5 years where you are. Exponential growth is very hard because I can make the case for any new initiative, oh no, 5 years from now, it may not look too much today, and then you have no data. And I think that the problem when you talk about, you know, what is the value of Twitter? Well, you can compute the lifetime value of a customer and all this kind of stuff, and you know, what's the value of a search user? Well, the value of a search user is 10 to 100x, probably that of a Twitter user. So, but how do you calculate that? Google had no idea what the value of a searcher would be in 99. And so,
but they had very much of an idea about the value they provide to somebody looking for information. And that, in some way, is the much more computable problem.
So this is the this is very much the Tim O'Reilly argument. Make something that's valuable. right? Which is sort of at the end, don't worry about the money as much. Make something that's valuable, and good things will happen. So, which is a very reasonable argument, I think, for a lot of more technical innovations. So anyway.
Yes. To the third point.
Second.
The second point.
Real work requires accountability. So there are lots of little crowdsourcing things. There are, and there's this view, for example, that Wikipedia is a distributed intelligence of people making it happen. Yet, there's a small number of people who have taken accountability for making Wikipedia work. And so this whole notion of the world is a brotherhood and we don't need managers and people work together doesn't work. And I summarize this in a different way. You can't yell at a crowd. At the end, the world is changed by a small number of people, typically, who take accountability. And we talked about how hard it is to say yes. Right? Steve Jobs always talks about that the trick to manage leading his company is not saying yes, it's saying no. All the things that he doesn't want to do, which is really another way to say, well, what is he saying yes to? And so who are the people who lead by saying yes to something? Those are the people that take accountability for the outcome. And I will tell you something. In corporate America, the people who rise, and this is going to be reactionary, are the people who do not ever take accountability for a decision that might make them wrong.
Very interesting. That's what I've always said about China. That the people who make it in China, who stay in China, are the ones who never made mistakes. And the safest way to not make mistakes is just to not do anything.
To not do anything or to make a big deal out of decisions that at the end don't matter. Is this color red or blue? No one cares. For example, your car color. And you can spend endless committees. But the hard decisions, which are the ones where if it's wrong, you would lose your job, those are the ones that a lot of people shy away from. Well, and so you get really, that's the Peter principle. I mean, you sort of get the rise of the people who never made a mistake.
Yeah. And my view is actually, the reason I actually like to just, you know, be a one-man show is that there clearly is nobody who I can blame.
Yeah. It is perfect accountability. It is exactly what it is. And so now the reality is, right, so now that's interesting, but there are problems in the world you need to solve with hundreds of people because you can't answer 100 phone calls at the same time. You might find a way to do it.
No, my poor friends, they know I push them to voicemail more than I could. But through Skydeck, I have a good transcription service now, which I forwarded your voicemail this morning.
I have a number of stories where that's bad. Well, you know, it puts my voicemail, which is protected under the law, into the legal record by being transcribed. And the whole transcription of voicemail thing is going to blow up at some point in time. There's some big case, because voicemail is protected communication, right?
But is it? If I leave a recording for you,
by law, my employer is not allowed to listen to it. Right? There are all these rules, and I've never understood it, quite frankly. It
makes no sense.
Why the phone system is protected and email is not, but for whatever it's worth, right? You cannot record me on the phone system. Like, you need to have a signal that beeps and things like that.
But if you leave me a voicemail, you are clearly aware that it's being recorded. Okay, I'm a lawyer, you're not a lawyer.
It's a nice edge case. I'm very curious what it is.
Yes.
It's a good question. Anyway, point being is the voicemail does go in the email record, discovery record. So, who knows? Rule number three. People are not a commodity. We treat them, we want them to be, because you want to achieve high quality. Yet, as we've talked about before, you know, they learn and they adapt and they learn from each other. And as we go back to small teams and shared goals, at the end, if you try to treat 10 workers like 1,000 workers in this traditional crowdsourcing, you can't deal with large workforces. So Wikipedia, again, 30,000 people who control the topics, very different than hoping that 1 million people. So 1 million monkeys typing on a typewriter will never write Shakespeare. And in fact, I'm sure if you've figured out the math, right? Each character has 32 choices. I mean, infinite number of. So I think any system that doesn't recognize that there are better or worse people and starts optimizing towards that doesn't really perform optimally. And we're talking, all this is about optimization, right? I mean, at the end, you know, Lord of the Flies, it's just that lowest common denominator in the world just leads to randomness, not to self-organization. I'll throw this as a hypothesis. I'm sure there's a million ways to disprove it.
Four.
Distributed work is enabled by your ability to measure quality.
On a microscopic, highly granular level.
That's right. Because the only way that I can trust you, because traditional systems don't get tested, because I sit next to you, I see what you do, I can supervise it. Distributed work requires much more discipline, right? We set goals, we agree upon goals, and massively distributed work like Wikipedia, unless you have some way to judge if something is good or bad, you cannot distribute work to people. And so that's sort of the next one, which is the more you can measure a task, I'll say this at Colliery, the more you can measure a task, the easier it is to distribute. Because trust and measurement sort of are interchangeable in some way. There's some larger concept here, I'm not sure what it is. But that you can trade trust for measurability. There's something there.
And as you said in German, Vertrauen ist gut, Kontrolle ist besser.
Yep. Yeah.
Trust is good, measurement is better.
But then there are some emotional connections also. I'm sure there's sort of some end state where, from your personal life perspective, you wouldn't want to measure everything versus having implicit trust.
Right. For me, trust and reputation are shortcuts, which allow us, heuristics, which allow us to make, you know, actual decisions as opposed to not making decisions, which is a decision by itself.
I think that's right, but they also eliminate assumptions, right? Every single person that you meet, you don't have to reestablish. They don't have a gun. They won't kill me. They're you know, in some ways, laws and rules and habits are established so that we can be much more efficient in our communication. And I think, actually, as a colliery, most strong companies have very strong cultures that you don't have to re-justify everything. So I'll give you an example. Apple, you would never have to argue for a good user interface. Lots of companies, you'll have to argue that it's important, can you measure it? It's just an assumption. And so no one will ever argue. Amazon, you never have to argue that data is important. Yet, tons of companies don't want it, right? Because the manager wants it to make the decision, and if you hand it off to data, well, then you lost the control of the decision. So I think these assumptions are underlined.
The culture means what goes without being questioned.
Yes, exactly.
Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher that Königsberg, once said that an argument stops, scientific argument that is, when the counterparty, you know, is content. So when they decide, you know, yeah, I believe this. I mean, you can go as far down, turtles upon turtles upon turtles upon turtles.
Right.
But at some stage, you say, yeah, I believe it. It means that it's been decomposed in a way which is consistent with your belief system.
Yes. So, for example, I cannot prove that black holes exist. Yet my belief system is that enough smart people that I trust have said they exist. So I don't have to question it. It would be very dreary to have to reinvent every single element of shared trust. So Microsoft, for example, believes everything was about APIs. Because you create an ecosystem, you bring it together, you create sort of, you know, and the monopoly, obviously. So I think most strong companies have a very strong set of belief systems. Now, the problem with that is it doesn't allow for diversity, which is your point, which is why they typically get caught by the disruption. Because they view the world, and quite frankly, a lot of people have told me at Google, if if your idea fits into the paradigm of MapReduce and massive data, it works wonderful. If it doesn't fit in that paradigm, it is very difficult to make it happen. So I think if your ecosystem is successful, if your culture is strong, if your values are strong, it's wonderfully efficient, but it doesn't allow for enough diversity. Rule of. Okay, the next one is really fun.
Next one is number 5.
Number 5. Everyone wins through visibility.
Everyone wins through visibility.
Visibility. I'll give you a...
Not necessarily the view many organizations have. If you think about
absolutely.
McKinsey or whatever your favorite consultancy
no.
is.
It is revolutionary. And I'll give you the
That's
example.
Say, yeah.
It takes courage. Maynard Webb, and actually Google does this too, mails his objective to the entire company every quarter. Then he has his team grade him on having achieved them and mails his grade to the company. Total transparency of what he was trying to do that quarter and if he got it done. Very brutal. It's like when you blog for the first time, you have privacy concerns, people will watch me, yet you learn as you expose visibility that you gain so much more of having that information and not having to argue about it every time. And I'll give you the simplest example. When you, and in our case, we do business process outsourcing. When you hire an outsourcer, that outsourcer will try to charge you as much money as you can, right? Why not?
As he can.
Yeah, why not? And then he or she will find the cheapest labor they possibly can to hit the quality of what you're looking for. Because they're hiding their margin between what they're charging and what they're paying. Well, it's a blind relationship. In a visible marketplace where you know what they make, you as the customer can make the trade-off. And if you know, let's say the owner of the BPO charges 10% overhead, right? Oh my God, I exposed my margin. The owner suddenly can say, well, I don't like this quality. Let me add a little more value. Maybe we can find better people. Or let me try to pay these guys $5 and these guys $3. Suddenly the payer feels empowered because they have visibility across the entire supply chain. Every supply chain member today tries to hide their costs. Of course, why not? What would happen if we expose the cost truly all the way? Would people really, because, you know, and there's a lot of theory on negotiation and things like that, but marketplaces traditionally have added tremendous visibility and eliminated efficiencies, right? I mean, you can watch and look what happened in the U.S. economy with all this lack of visibility, what's going on behind the scenes. Would we be better in a totally visible world? Well, it certainly would be a more efficient world. It'd be more brutal, and very few people really like being judged publicly. You know, our CEO likes puts himself out there, and his belief is that by eliminating all invisible side things, he creates transparency. And a transparent world is a meritocracy world.
Yes.
And he, at his heart, he believes the future of work is all about transparency and meritocracy. So visit...
Because I believe that the future of work is about matches, about matching or matches, on relatively small units. Not, I work for company X for the next 10 years, but hey, I'll come by for 2 hours and help you out. And for those matches to be done well, it's not the 1 or 2 days of interview.
That's
you
right.
do it, you know, talking to Jeff Bezos, and Jeff says, you know, why don't you come work for me? But it is based on persistent history, on transparency.
Which industry does this already? There's one industry that does it. Perfectly.
Let me think.
It's south of here. It's in Los
movie
Angeles.
Movie industry?
Yes.
Yeah.
Total. If you make a movie, there is no company.
Yes.
It's all ad hoc.
Good one. Yeah.
It is hundreds of small companies coming together
yes.
for a period of a month or 2 months, all by reputation, total transparency, movie editing, actors, everybody's their own company. Future of work right there.
Very interesting. Two remarks on that. One, I for some of the videos I do for my class, I actually posted on Craigslist an ad, and what amazing talent you get, and what diversity in responses you have. I never see this when I look for a programmer. That's very interesting. So, for instance, I had one person I'm doing with a social network in the area.
Right.
A project on understanding virtual gifts versus real gifts. And I told to a filmmaker about it. She said, "Oh, Andreas, I always see the movie. It's called 99 Red Roses. And I want to do this for you. I'll do it for free." Because she already saw the imagery about, sending somebody virtual, sending them. So that's amazing that, one man show meets one woman show.
Yep. And I think it is ironically, programming, has traditionally labor marketplace have been around programming, right? Programmers sort of write tools to each other, Odesk, all that stuff. Yet it's the industry that's actually theoretically the hardest one to do it for. Because it is very information rich. And we talked about measuring quality and things like that, right? And it's very difficult. I tell you to write something. But one of the problems with programming is that to truly specify what you need to do, the code is the most efficient way to describe what it actually is. That's the crux of programming, right? I mean, in a movie, you can say, "I want a red rose," and it goes here and explodes, and like a couple of words, and then there's an imagery, and you share it. Programming, here's the program. That's the most efficient way to describe it. Well, wait, I just did your job for you.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the true challenges in programming, which is why it's so difficult to factor it out, right? And that's why because the communication in your head is so much faster. I think this is why the whole surgical programming model works, right? Because if you can have the whole components in your head, your decision ability is 1,000 times faster than even 3 people talking. So, anyway.
Yeah.
Everybody wins with visibility. It's a theory, yet it's apparent.
Not everybody. I think the organization wins, but I don't think it's a zero-sum game, but some people lose. Some people are good talkers, and their stories will crumble, disappear, be swept away, looking outside the window here, into the bay, will be swept away by the waves.
And all the good people in the world rejoice, right?
And one thing I've never understood is that I'm sure the same must have happened to you. You see resumes, people look good, you interview them and say, "Oh my God, I would have never, hired that person." And then, a week later, you hear that they got a job at respectable company XYZ. How is this possible?
Assumptions,
matches. That's why I'm so interested in matching. It's ultimately about matching. I think matching people.
It is matching, but it is an imperfect society. And I think I started economics, and I got disinterested immediately when I was told that actually all the theories of perfect information matches don't actually work. And then the rest of economics has been explaining why people behave differently than the models. Right, as you said, losing a dollar is so much worse for people than winning a dollar.
Well, not me, Danny Kahneman.
What's that?
Danny Kahneman, not me.
Yeah, well, but there are all these tests, right? If people lose a pound, they have to pay a dollar, versus if they lose a pound, they gain a dollar, and the people who gain the dollar don't lose anyway.
Number six. The last one.
We just want to sit a week. Communities require recognition and social interaction. In other words, the water cooler is important. We cannot always be perfect and just focused on work and go in and leave. And traditional crowdsourcing, right? For example, you throw a task, there's no social interaction. It's just, here's the work, did you do it? Were you the best one? Next. And I just don't think that social ecosystems, we are social by nature, right? And I think people actually are very, very interesting is small groups, people are socialistic. Large groups, people are capitalistic. Like from 100,000 years ago, people were sort of small tribes, and the tribe had to work together, but the tribes fought each other. Total capitalism between tribes, pretty much socialism within the crowd. I mean, like your family, right? You take what you need, but try to take, you know, the toy from your daughter, you'll see what happens. But, you know, industrial competition between countries, between others, it's all about really winning. And so I think people have been struggling with those two emotions. I mean, because you don't want to be perfectly socialistic in your family, you don't want to be perfect capitalistic. But I think you cannot reduce work to a perfectly repeatable process without accounting for the water cooler. It's very, very important, right? Because I think, you know, and the Army has recognized that by forming units, right, creating small units, making them feel together, because then they're a team, they feel they can perform better because their goal is not just for themselves, but they sort of naturally fill their social function. And I think, for example, the Katarina and Stuart Butterfield at Flickr recognized that very early, in that they didn't just create a photo sharing site, but they let people connect to talk about the photo sharing. And, you know, Katarina has just a number of wonderful insights in how communities work and how you have to slice large communities into very small communities very quickly. Because if you are surrounded by 10 people, if you're by yourself, you're alone. If you're with 10 people, you are with a community. If you're with 10,000 people, you're alone again. And the recognition of no one wants to really be alone is, I think, what drove Flickr. And so they partition things that people feel like small teams inside of a giant. And so I think that is actually very counter to what traditional crowdsourcing looks like today. There is no accounting for the social element.
It would be interesting to look at Ning, for instance, which has almost a million social networks on them now. And look at activity versus member size of the network. And see whether what you just described, this inverse U-shaped curve, shows there as well.
Now, remember that Ning communities can slice and dice into sub-communities, right? There are message boards and things like that. And there was just a study, done on Facebook. Cameron Marlowe, do you know him on Facebook?
Yes.
So Cameron did an analysis of how many people you actually interacted with regularly within your Facebook social network. It was something like 8. Hundreds of friends, you interacted with 8. Or 5, or I forgot the number was. So there's that same effect, right?
So that's which reminds me of Roy Radner at Bell Labs in the olden days did a study of the optimal number of people you have working for you. And it was 7, just like George Miller's plus 7 plus minus 2 or 4. It seems to be a reasonable number of so what you can keep track of.
So a large web portal, we won't mention their name, did a study of, they looked at Messenger, friend lists, and they looked at retention versus number of friends you had. Do you want to know what the plot looks like?
Yes.
It took up at 8. As soon as you had 8 friends, I think it was 8 or 9, I could be a little mistaken, retention just dramatically jumped. So there was a magic number at which somehow, you know, 2 or 3, you never quite connected. 8, maybe the probability that you have to say something to somebody at least once a day was high enough. There's a magic threshold. And, you know, there's 2 pizzas, there's 7 people, there's like, and I read an article at Amazon where they said the 2 pizza team is powerful and then the 100 person. Is powerful because in 100 people, every person isn't a role, it's a name. You don't say finance, but you say Joe. You don't say, you know, chief, the department of the chief scientist, but you say Andreas. And I think those are the 2 magic numbers, right? 100 and maybe 10. And I think if you don't acknowledge those limits, you do not get optimal performance out of people.
So for the future of work, which is defined for me by having multiple relationships, having no value placed on doing things now for the future. But you do things now for the present, and you get compensated for them. And hey, if you do them well, I'll hire you again. If you don't do them well, then no, it's a big world. So as opposed to, you know, you helped me out here to help me meet my deadline, and when time comes, I'll think about whether I'll help you out or not.
So that's interesting, though. I mean, for example, you went to college. You spent a lot of time, and maybe for you it was a passion. For a lot of people, it is delayed gratification. And I'm sure you've seen this study that, you know, when they look at small kids, delayed gratification is a higher predictor of success than intelligence. The ability to work for future payoff is a stronger indicator that you will succeed in life than your intelligence. There's a famous, you've heard the marshmallow test. They did this at Bing where they put a marshmallow in front of a child, and they said, when I come back, you will get a second marshmallow.
And if it's still there.
If it's still there. And they said there were groups of children that would do anything. They would run around the room, they'd sing little songs, but they were determined to get that future benefit. And then there were a group of kids that just would eat it and eat it. And they then followed those kids to life. And so when you said work only for the present, all the successful people think about their future. And we are the only animals.
But they think about their future, but they don't put their future in the hand of others.
So apprenticeship does not exist.
I think this decomposition or this strong discounting of a future in a work in a world that is very non-stationary. It might have been different when we lived in caves. I mean, not you and me, but you know, our ancestors in Germany. And that world, the time scale of change was slow compared to the time scale of lives, which happened to be short those days.
Right.
But for us, promises of the time scale of a few years, I think those people have the ability to adapt. And that means to not cling onto, you know, things other people promise them for a time which they basically can't promise things, as you saw in the economy the last 2 years.
Right.
Something there, I'm not yet really clear about it, but maybe it's going back to what we said at the beginning, like this portfolio approach.
Right. So the cost of information 1,000 years ago was almost infinite. Right. It was some guy riding a horse or running for miles, and you didn't know what happened in the next town. Maybe they had a disease. And the cost of information, you know, the telegraph happened, the phone happened, Twitter is happening. The cost of information now is zero. And I'm trying to think of what are we trading, right? Because in the old days, right, it's not free. You're trading for something else. And this world of transparency where everybody, you know, is in Hollywood, and I would actually say what you see happening in Hollywood, everything is about who you know, not what you know. I mean, that's a friend of mine is making a movie right now in Hollywood, and he's sort of just getting introduced to the scene.
And I would deconstruct what knowing means. I mean, not in the biblical sense, but in the sense that, are they going to actually listen to you? Are they going to return your phone calls? Or do you just know the guy because he's a famous guy in the movies?
So I'm assuming there is implied trust, right? So everything 20 years ago was about information monopolies, right?
Asymmetries.
Newspapers, exactly. Newspapers are really information monopolies. They control the flow of information. Their role has disappeared, right? Because there is no more monopoly. And they had trust implicitly because you trust the New York Times or you don't. Now, since the monopoly information has disappeared, trust has suddenly become the thing, right? What gets your attention? You know, do you like Tech Meme is one of those wonderful sort of like, what do they trust? And so Hollywood, right? I mean, it used to be you went to the local guy to get your shoes fixed. Why? Because you didn't know about anybody else. you know, the store. Now we have Yelp. Transformation, transparency, but trust is what it comes down to. One bad review on Yelp, right? People are having lawsuits on this. And so Hollywood, right? It used to be physical proximity was what it's all about. You moved to New York because you were doing banking and things like that. Who you trust in an information-full industry, I think, because you now have an infinite number of choices, right? Before, you were limited in your choice. And the future of work, and now we throw it all together. I'll mention the call center. And I love the call center because it is measurable, right? Your job, my job, they're very random. They're very difficult to measure because many of the decisions you make a year from now, we'll know if they were right or not. Call centers, you have thousands of people doing the same job, and it's perfectly measurable. So they're great industrial psychology experiments. It used to be in a call center, everything was physical proximity. Did you live within 50 miles of the call center? And you know what? When you build one, then the competition built the next one and the next one. And it was like what's happening in the forest, right? They just sort of cut all the forest down. So basically, and there are all these regions in the United States where you build a call center. Within 50 miles, you get every person of talent in there. Why do you get a job? It's like the union. You got a job because you lived there, you knew somebody. Now, call centers become virtual. All about reputation.
Because the call center has left.
The building, yes. Thank you. The call center has left the building. But in that world, building your reputation, so future benefits, right? You know, you got a PhD. Or for you, that was probably not a choice. But I mean, lots of people sort of invest in this. You got a law degree. Not because necessarily you love it, but your future earnings might be really high and people will trust you because you learned it and you graduated from Harvard. So reputation, which is already in the, you know, in the professional classes a big deal, is now becoming more and more, I think, for every job. Like LinkedIn. So Reid Hoffman said, everybody is now their own company. Well, as a company, accounts payable, receivable. So I actually think this whole notion of information transparency drives the value of reputation up in a non-linear fashion. Because, right, I mean, it used to be your physical limits were in Wall Street. You could trade as much as you could on the floor, yell at people. Now with one click, you can get $1 billion moved around. And so I think electronically we can leverage ourselves infinitely. You know, you can extend your own brain through Mechanical Turk or whatever, as you can get millions of things done. So that's easy. But the trust of, you know, I will trust you with $1 billion. That's hard. So I think, you know, reputation, global reputation, which is really, you know, well-known professors, musicians, but then it was, you know, a local orchestra playing in Baden, Switzerland, right? Well, there happened to be three guys in the town who can play the violin. Well, that's how many musicians were equal. Now the megastars happen, right? Information could travel everywhere. Music can travel everywhere. All the assets got sort of, you know, concentrated in the people with the best reputation or talent, whatever you want to call it. So now imagine a world where every person has to watch their reputation all the time. So that's the future of work.
And that's what you call LiveWorks launching on the
7th.
7th of April, 2009.
Knock on wood.
Thank you.
Thank you.